session is sponsored by Dialogue, a Journal of Mormon Thought. Early in the year, we decided when we met with these gentlemen in California that there was one very, very significant centennial that should not be ignored. We have centennials and bicentennials and other annuals that I can't even know how to pronounce that we always celebrate in a variety of ways. But this year for Utah and Western history, the centennial of the Manifesto, we felt was a very important topic that needed to be discussed. We introduced this as a possible session for Sunstone, and I think they liked the idea, so now there's another session later on in the evening. But we're very honored today to have two scholars from universities in California, both with Utah roots and various educational sojourns in Utah, to join us. We'll first hear from Leo Lyman. Leo is a native of Delta, Utah, who has degrees from SUSC and BYU and a PhD from UC Riverside. Has been teaching in California for over two decades, has spent a good share of his professional and academic life researching the 1880s, 1890s of Utah history, and his book, Political Deliverance, is a critically acclaimed volume on this period and on the quest for Utah's quest for statehood and what it meant and the role of polygamy and the abandonment of polygamy by the Manifesto, what that meant, at least politically. Carmen Hardy will then give his paper. These are papers, by the way, not panels. At the end, we'll have time for discussion. Carmen Hardy and Victor Jorgensen are currently working on a book on this period and on polygamy, and especially on the sexuality of polygamy that will be published soon. Carmen's also a native of Utah with a bachelor's degree from Washington State, which makes him an educational kinsman of myself, and a PhD from Wayne State University with an interlude at Provo with a master's degree. He went back to BYU and taught, but for the last 24 years has also been teaching at California State University at Fullerton. He has done, as both of these gentlemen have, numerous articles on the period, and Carmen especially on American constitutional history and interpretations of the Constitution. So we'll begin with Leo, we'll follow that with Carmen, then I'll have some comments, and then we'll turn them to the wolves.
Thank you. The title of my paper is The Political Background of the Woodruff Manifesto. At the centennial of Wilford Woodruff's announcement on plural marriages, there's still considerable misunderstanding as to what the manifesto was and how it came about. Most people who know anything about the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and the long struggle with the United States government over the practice of polygamy know that the Woodruff announcement was pivotal in relieving mounting pressures and that it was in some way instrumental in attaining Utah statehood. But there are many details in the political background to these events which have remained obscure. This paper seeks to place the Woodruff Manifesto in the context of these developments. From the beginning of Mormon settlement in the Great Basin, church leaders and their political friends recognized the need to attain statehood to gain political independence. As long as they were a territory, that would mean they would get carpetbag appointed officials from outside. But when they announced that they were practicing polygamy in 1852, the church essentially doomed any real possibility for attaining their desired political independence for years to come. The infant Republican Party, in its first platform in 1856, made a statement against polygamy and the Mormon practice of it. And for the next three decades, the Republican Party would crusade against that twin relic as well as the slavery one. After the Civil War, two of the most powerful members of the House of Representatives, important in giving Utah statehood, a couple of guys named Colfax and Ashley, actually visited Utah and told the Mormon leaders that they would never attain statehood as long as the practice of plural marriage continued, but the Mormons continued to practice what they considered their divinely commanded institution. As time went on, the bitterness increased. By the 1880s, the anti-polygamy raid had full national support. In 1887, the Edmunds Tucker Act was passed, aimed at weakening the church through confiscating most of the property that the church held. Church lobbyists tried to stop that, but failed. After that, they tried another proposal to soften the blow of the legislation. It was called the Scott Amendment, which proposed to delay the effect of the new law, the Edmunds Tucker, for 6 months, and perhaps in that interim, Utah would hold a constitutional convention where its own delegates would prohibit polygamy in their own constitution. By that time, several church agents, including John W. Young, a general authority and a railroad promoter, had established close contacts with nationally prominent Democrats, including President Grover Cleveland and several of his chief advisors, including Solicitor General George A. Jenks, who, as it turned out, actually drafted the constitutional provision for Utah prohibiting polygamy, and visited Utah during the summer of 1887 when that constitutional convention was being held and enacting that particular provision. Even more crucial was the reaction to the Scott Amendment of the highest leaders of the church. President John Taylor's initial response was negative, mainly because he believed that approval of a constitutional statement against plural marriage might convey the impression that church leaders or their followers intended to surrender on the principle of plural marriage. In continuing communications between Washington, D.C. and Salt Lake City, mainly through C.W. Penrose, the sometime Deseret News editor and member of the Salt Lake State Presidency, Penrose argued to the brethren in Salt Lake that in accepting a constitution was purely a political matter in which non-polygamous Mormons, the only ones able to vote anyway, were simply acting in their capacity as citizens. Polygamists were not committing themselves on the matter at all, although Penrose also suggested that there may be a benefit for the polygamists because enforcement of the laws would be carried out by locally elected officials instead of the less sympathetic outside appointees, should statehood come. President Taylor finally approved of the Scott Amendment approach after being informed that President Grover Cleveland was anxious for such a response. But in accepting that approach, he reiterated that it shouldn't be construed that the church leaders were in any way hinting at changes in church doctrine. He also indicated he understood Penrose's arguments by saying that at worst they would only be punishing themselves for what their enemies were now punishing them for. Even though the brethren seemed to have an understanding with the administration of Grover Cleveland, it's clear they didn't have as much of an understanding with the Democratic majority in Congress, who were not so easily convinced that a simple constitutional clause was sufficient evidence of a change in Mormon practices. In September 1887, a document presumably drafted by someone high in the Democratic leadership in Congress sent a document to a group of the apostles in Salt Lake City, and it basically stated that unless the Mormons who were summoned before the Utah courts to answer charges of polygamy and unlawful cohabitation shall promise to obey the laws against that offense, it would be impossible to bring Congress of the United States to believe that the church leaders were being honest in adopting the constitutional provision prohibiting polygamy. Church attorneys prepared a statement to try and adjust to the demands of Congress, but the apostles concluded that, quote, no Latter-day Saint could make such a promise and still be true to covenants he had made with God and his brethren, end quote. So this determination to not go along with the demands of Congress basically stopped the most concerted effort for statehood yet, probably the sixth attempt that Utah had made. And even though the brethren had decided not to go for statehood right then, if it meant giving up something on polygamy, Democratic leaders continued cognizance of the fact that they needed allegiance of this large group of voters in the West, and that Utah statehood would be beneficial to the Democratic Party. And the chairman of the Territorial Committee of the House of Representatives, William Springer, thereafter proposed a constitutional amendment to the U.S. Constitution, providing that should a state fail to enforce its polygamy laws, Congress could intervene with proper measures of enforcement. Even though it seemed that the other members of Congress who were friendly to Utah liked that proposal, church leaders said that they would have nothing to do with it, so again, they rejected the proposal as too restrictive. Similarly, for a third time, at the end of 1888, there was an attempt from friends in the East, and we don't know exactly who that is, to persuade general authorities to make some real compromise on plural marriage. And church leaders discussed a document that was sent for a third time, but again, they concluded that it was asking Latter-day Saints to promise too strictly to conform to the laws of the land. And so, as that term of Congress ended and the Democratic majority, so did any real attempt at statehood among the Democrats, including those who were from Utah, most Mormons being Democrats at that time. This was rejection of the last attempt at Utah statehood possible by Democrats for some time to come, because the reins of national government were about to devolve on the Republican president, Benjamin Harrison, accompanied by a friendly Republican majority in Congress. The new president and many fellow Republicans were still determined to deal firmly with Mormons to bring them into conformity with the law. And this featured a truly harsh measure that would deny the right to vote to members of the church even who didn't practice polygamy. But there were other Republicans who were beginning to seek Mormon political allegiance, which could only happen after some had become disillusioned or disenchanted with the Democrat Party. Ironically, the party that most effectively wielded the heavy hand ended up benefiting most politically from Mormon support. Pivotal to this political transition was Mormon disappointment with the role of members of the formerly friendly Democratic Party in instituting what was first known as the Idaho Test Oath. And it was mostly Democrats who originated that and implemented it. And although the church leaders in Idaho tried desperately to fight that, especially by having bishops and stake presidents appear before the court testifying that they had not taught nor contracted polygamous marriages in the last couple years, that approach didn't carry much weight, particularly with a new judge just appointed to the Idaho Territorial Courts, a guy named Barry from Minnesota. Even though the leading Mormon advocate in Idaho, William Budge, visited him personally and argued that their friends on the national level sympathized with their approach and that it would mean a great deal of harm to the Democratic Party should decisions upholding the Idaho Test Oath take effect. Barry made the decision based on his own conscience, rejected the Mormon arguments, basically said that the abandonment of polygamy was only temporary, that it would have to be an act by the general authorities from Salt Lake and from General Conference, and that hadn't happened. And even more ominous, early in 1890, after appeals through the territorial court system, The Idaho test oath was upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court, and it was only a matter of time before legislation making that a nationwide law would be initiated. Actually, the Cullum and Struble bills introduced in the spring of 1890 in Congress. And they showed every indication of breezing through to passage until Mormon agents, led by George Q. Cannon, learned that there were Republican leaders inclined to be more friendly. One of these, James S. Clarkson, later recalled that at the time that this Cullum and Struble legislation was pending, he and the foremost strategist of the Republican Party, James G. Blaine, were studying elements of voters in the United States to try and secure a majority for the political principles in which they believed. They had given up on the South. They believed the West was where they could gain a majority. And basing their conclusions on the work of several Mormon lobbyists, Isaac Trumbull and M.M. Estey, who had generated some membership figures, inflated membership figures, from church records and from the U.S. Census just taken before that, Blaine and Clarkson became impressed with the, quote, magnitude of the Mormon people, the greatness of their development in many states besides Utah, and the large part they were sure to bear, for good or evil, in the destiny of this republic. Now, Clarkson's pretty flowery in his reports to President Wilford Woodruff about the role that James G. Blaine plays. The most decisive event, Clarkson said, was when Blaine appeared at a congressional committee hearing on the Cullum or Struble bills, protesting against such an outrage upon any portion of a free people, asserting that no republic of free men could tolerate such wrong and live. Clarkson concluded his account saying, "Of course your people know something of the courage and loyalty of Mr. Blaine towards you in opposition, in oppression," but he continued, "the summit of and sublimity of it all was reached when he stood in the small committee room and smote down with the giant strength of his indignant wrath the further attempt in a free government to degrade still further a people already wronged too much." At about this same time, when prospects are too good for the Cullum-Struble bill, Delegate to Congress from Utah, John T. Kane, in desperation, called on one of the few Utah members of the church already affiliated with the Republican Party, Frank J. Cannon, editor of the Ogden Standard, and former assistant to Kane, to come and testify before a Senate committee on territories. And his testimony was an effective exposition of the grossly unfair aspects of the proposed Cullum and Struble bills. He stated, referring to the Edmunds-Tucker law, that it barred polygamists from participation as active American citizens. And he said, "Our parents were punished for an act, but the Cullum-Struble bill proposes to punish us for a thought." He explained that the intended law sought to restrict a class of people who had obeyed the law and expressed every intention of continuing to do so, and in other ways testifies that the law is grossly unfair. Now, Delegate Kane didn't know that young Cannon was back east to assist his father, who was personally directing the church fight against passage of the Cullum-Struble bills in their own way. Under George Q. Cannon's guidance, Frank Cannon conferred with James G. Blaine, who had been a friend of the elder Cannon when he had been delegate to Congress. Now Blaine's Secretary of State in the Harrison administration, and he instructed Cannon to make private personal pleas to individual committee members considering the Cullum and Struble bills, with the assurance of assistance from Secretary Blaine should any members of the committees be hesitant. However, Blaine warned that such influence would only be temporary, and to permanently alleviate the problem could only occur if the Latter-day Saints would, quote, get into line, end quote, so far as marriage practices were concerned. When Frank Cannon reported that to his father, President Cannon divulged, according to Frank Cannon's sometimes questionable under the prophet in Utah, and I need to properly express the questionability of that source. President Woodruff has been praying. He thinks he sees some light. You're authorized to say that something will be done in regard to a change in stance on polygamy. With this, young canon approached the committee members, informing them confidentially of the message from his father. He recalled conferring with influential Republican members of the Senate committee, like Orville Platt from Connecticut, along with others, saying he told them that the Mormon Church was about to make a concession concerning the doctrine of polygamy. Frank Cannon later claimed that these assurances at least temporarily halted progress on these bills, and the sponsor of the bill, Mayor Baskin from Salt Lake City, agreed with that. It's clear that political considerations were also important in persuading Republican sponsors to postpone the Kellum and Struble bills, which they did after those approaches by Frank J. Cannon and perhaps by James G. Blaine. When President Cannon returned to Salt Lake City, he reported to fellow church leaders that the outlook for Utah was brighter than it had been for many years. He alluded to the Clarkson-Blaine strategy of increasing the number of Mormon Republicans in the West in a revealing statement that, quote, "We would doubtless have been disfranchised by the Struble bill if the Republican leaders in Washington had not been given to understand that there were Republicans in Utah and that a wise course on the part of the Republicans would doubtless make more," end quote. Several weeks after that crisis is averted, Frank Cannon's brother, Apostle Abram H. Cannon, is in New York City for medical treatment, and while visiting his father there, he was shown a paper drafted by Blaine, who expressed hope that church authorities would accept it. Young Cannon described the document as making a, quote, "virtual renunciation of plural marriage," end quote, which the dedicated young polygamist admitted caused his personal feelings to revolt at the prospect of signing such a promise. And it's possible that this document was much revised within the ensuing weeks, but within a month, the same apostle, Abram Cannon, noted in his diary a private reading of an important First Presidency resolution dated June 30, 1890, in regard to plural marriage. It was to the effect that no such marriages would be permitted to occur, even in Mexico, unless the contracting parties, or at least the female, was resolved to remain in the Mormon colonies recently established there largely for that purpose. This quiet dictum is a most significant development in the subject of plural marriage, as it's a concession such as had recently been promised to Republican leaders. Though the Woodruff Manifesto, issued almost 3 months later, is usually emphasized as the most important step, the manifesto was in a very real sense merely a public announcement of a policy previously implemented. There are a lot of illustrations of how this document or this announcement impacted. I'm going to have to cut by a letter from Joseph F. Smith to one of his closest friends, Charles W. Nibley, who's approaching him about permission for an additional marriage, either for himself or for a close friend. And President Smith says, "The times have changed, conditions are not propitious, and the decree of the powers that be are against the move." And he's not just talking about outsiders, but powers in the church. Smith said, "The decree now is that there shall be no plural marriages in the United States, and that there should be none anywhere else unless one or both parties remove beyond the jurisdiction." There are other details of that, but President Smith makes it very clear that they're going to apply that decree. At about the same time, he tells another close associate, L. John Nettle, "We're making a strong effort to do something in defense of the rights of our Monog brethren," adding a hope that the church leaders could do as much in their behalf as they've done in ours, meaning standing loyally by the church in its time of crisis because of the Edmunds Tucker and the Cullum Struble bills. This, I believe, was an announcement that the church would no longer sanction new plural marriages, removing polygamy as an issue, as an obstacle to Utah statehood, by absolving the formal church organization of responsibility for the continuance of plural marriages. Those later charged with such offense would have to stand on their own responsibility. Under such circumstances, monogamous Mormons could not justifiably be disfranchised or denied statehood simply because some who happened to be members of the church still continued the offensive practice on their own. Now, church members heard about this announcement in June, but non-Mormons outside, particularly the Utah Commission, charged with trying to come up with evidence for new laws against polygamy, hadn't heard anything, and they continued to try and gather their information, and in a fall report, the Utah Commission report to Congress, they alleged that there were 41 Mormons who had entered plural marriage in Utah territory since the previous report. There may have been some. The evidence presented is not very substantial, and several church leaders referred to the report as blatantly false. Some expected the Utah Commission report to generate tremendous trouble for the church. President Woodruff is quoted as saying, as being apprehensive that the Utah Commission report might well lead to further legislation inimical to the church. That fall is a busy time for the First Presidency. There's one trip to New Mexico, there's another to San Francisco. There are a lot of things suggested that they were doing in San Francisco, and maybe they did meet with some prominent Republicans. But I don't think it had much to do with the manifesto. There are people who disagree with me on that. I know that Abraham Cannon says in his diary that they went out of the state to avoid subpoenas to appear before courts interested in church property suits. In their absence, such hearings did commence before a Colonel M.N. Stone, a special commissioner appointed by the Utah Supreme Court to review accounts actions of Frank Dyer, who was receiver of church property, confiscated under that Edmunds Tucker Act. A primary purpose of these proceedings was to determine if earlier decrees of the Supreme Court prevented further government efforts to secure church property not already in the hands of the receivers. And it looks very much like the property that the prosecutors are looking for is the Utah temples. And they're probing for a way to try to get their hands on those or confiscate those. Within a week after the First Presidency's return in September 1890, President Woodruff confided in his diary the oft-quoted observation, "I've arrived at a point in the history of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints when I'm under the necessity of acting for the temporal salvation of the Church." Now, he specifically mentions the anti-polygamy legislation. I believe temporal salvation of the Church could certainly also include trying to save the temples. In fact, one of President Woodruff's most recent conversations before the announcement of the manifesto is with Apostle Mariner W. Merrill, acting as president of the Logan Temple. And in the discussion, Merrill concludes in his journal that the manifesto seemed the only way to retain possession of our temples and continue the ordinance work for the living and the dead, which was considered of more importance than continuing the practice of plural marriage at the present time. That's an awfully clear statement by one of the men who's just talked to the prophet, and President Woodruff, in subsequent statements, now cited in the Doctrine and Covenants, says the same thing within the next year. These are worries pressing on the prophet, but none was new. Pressures at least as serious had been withstood in the past. Even if the church was figuratively back to the wall and practical considerations demanded concessions, that does not necessarily deny the possibility of divine inspiration, Woodruff and his associates claimed was his ultimate motivation. George Q. Cannon later told of the numerous earlier suggestions from within and outside the church that such action be taken. He explained the time chosen in terms easily understood by fellow believers by simply saying that at no time has the Spirit seemed to indicate that this should be done. We've waited for the Lord to move in the matter, and finally, September 24th, Woodruff felt what he deemed the spiritual direction, and the manifesto was the result. Now, there had been a lot of people help him write it. There had been a lot of deliberation. It's finally sent to Washington, D.C. to be announced by Delegate Kane in the newspapers back there in connection with letters from Kane denouncing the Utah Commission report. And it's very clear in Kane's letters and in President Woodruff's announcement that they're trying to counteract the possible damage that could be done because of the Utah Commission report. Most of the manifesto is basically denying allegations, but President Woodruff is also promising that he will submit to the laws as recently interpreted by the courts and will use his influence with church members to do likewise. Although word of the manifesto spread quickly throughout the Mormon communities, most general authorities withheld comment until the regular quorum meetings beginning September 30th, a week later. There they freely expressed their impressions regarding it, recorded in considerable detail in several of the diaries. They exhibited awareness of the need for an announcement to alter the increasingly negative public opinion regarding that aspect, polygamy, in the church. Several apostles agreed with Apostle Heber J. Grant, who, referring to the ban within the United States, stated, "President Woodruff had simply told the world what we had been doing, and if there's any advantage to secure by the manifesto, I feel that we should have them." But the most striking aspect is that these apostles are absolutely determined to stay with their wives and continue to have children. They don't feel that the manifesto impacts them directly at all. In fact, President Joseph F. Smith wrote to his plural wife, Sarah, and warned her that she would hear a pronunciamiento by President Woodruff in relation to our political and domestic status that would no doubt startle some folks. He assured her that it would not startle her. "Neither will you be worried about it, for you and the rest of us are all right." He explained that it was only, quote, "those who could and would not and now can't who will be affected by it. They may growl and find fault and censure, but not those who have done their whole duty." Here it's abundantly clear that those who had already been obedient to the divine injunction to enter plural marriage were considered beyond the sweep of the declaration. It was more an announcement of the fact that other Latter-day Saints had procrastinated too long and would not now be able to enter into living the presumed higher law. There's a lot of discussion after that. It's sustained by Conference of the Church, although apparently there are some silent dissents and other kinds of dissents. President Woodruff obviously expects that to gain some better treatment of wives and children from the plural marriages. And in a part of the paper I'm going to have to slide over, I discuss his letter to a member of the Attorney General's office asking if anything can be done to ease the pressure on those innocent participants in this practice. There is no immediate relief. And President Cannon finally, in the next conference, April 1891, asks the brethren to go even further to avoid the even appearance of coexistence or associating with those plural wives. And that remains the stance for some time. Finally, in the concluding paragraph of the paper, I quote another letter of President Joseph F. Smith, who will be responsible for the future implementation or whatever of plural marriage. And he, writing to one of the brethren, says this: "What the Lord requires is that we shall not bring upon ourselves the destruction intended by our enemies by persisting in a course in opposition to the law." President Woodruff has said, the Lord does not expect us to do something we can't do. He had mentioned in conference that there was a time when the people of the church were told to build a temple in Missouri. The mob wouldn't let him. There was a revelation to the prophet Joseph Smith that the sin would be on the mob's head and that the members of the church were relieved of the responsibility. And practicing plural marriage in 1890 and 1891 were in the same category. That ends my paper on a note that basically says that the Lord doesn't require destruction intended by enemies because of persisting in a course in opposition to the law, and that was the fundamental purpose for which the Woodruff Manifesto was promulgated. Thank you.
It's necessary and proper that I first acknowledge that some of the ideas presented in this paper are drawn from a manuscript that Victor W. Jorgensen has co-authored with me that focuses primarily upon the transition from a polygamous to a monogamous ideal in Mormon society. And even though that borrowing is a rather superficial one, it's only right that I indicate that some of what I say comes from that other work. The root idea, or I should first say that the title of the paper is Self-Blame and the Manifesto. The root idea involved in this presentation came to my hearing first as a child in the LDS Church. My wife says she remembers it also. That is, that the reason polygamy is no longer practiced is because the people were insufficiently worthy and it was taken away to be lived later at a time when the saints were more righteous and deserving. The political events of the Crusade became ingredients in my historical consciousness only later. It is rather like what I remember was told me in connection with cessation of the United Order, that it had to do with the people's worthiness, or more precisely, their lack of it. My paper is an attempt to resurrect and examine that earlier response. The essay also takes its inspiration from a work by Kenneth Stamp, in which he proposed that uncertainties and doubts relating to their cause profoundly affected the Southern mind, both during and after the American Civil War. Stamp's study, combined with a commentary on his thesis by Peter Loewenberg, suggests to me that something similar may have occurred with the Mormons. As I will explain, there was a fundamental difference between the Mormon polygamous circumstance and that described by Stamp in his examination of the South and its defense of slavery. Beyond this, I am addressing a strain of thought that emerged after 1890. While I believe that Stamp's approach has relevance for the coming of the manifesto, that is not the issue with which I am dealing in this paper. Neither am I seeking to diminish the causative significance of ingredients like political and economic distress as reasons accounting for why the manifesto was written. I wish only to draw attention to another element, one that emerged most visibly after 1890. This has to do with psychological dimensions of the conflict. And these, I will suggest, were fitted after the fact to the Mormon need for explaining why the manifesto occurred. The 2 decades previous to the Woodruff Manifesto are crucial for understanding Mormon appropriation of the document. Pressures created by the federal government's opposition to polygamy gave the time an intensity reminiscent in some ways of the Reformation of the 1850s. In 1870, Wilford Woodruff reminded a tabernacle audience that plurality was a commandment from heaven and that they must either obey it or be damned. "Now, which shall we obey?" Woodruff asked. "God or Congress? For it is God in Congress for it." The assembly with a loud voice answered, "We will obey God." In the spring of 1880, a special message from the authorities was read to church congregations throughout the territory, after which members were asked to pledge themselves to stand by the laws of God, whatever persecution and consequences may follow. Church members were told that it would amount to apostasy to renounce the principle, and that to do so would result in their rejection by God. The persecution raging against them was interpreted as but part of the trial and sifting associated with being among the elect. Mormons were reminded that they were like the Israelites in Egypt or the Christians in their early difficulties with Rome. They needed only keep the commandments and God would fight their battles for them. In late 1889, after some discussion among church authorities as to whether or not to suspend the practice of polygamy because of the severity of government efforts to end it, President Wilford Woodruff prayed for guidance on the question. In the words of Apostle Abraham H. Cannon, God's answer came quick and strong. President Woodruff was told that the saints should remain allegiant to the revelations already given to them. The Lord would protect them. The wicked, Woodruff was told, would not prevail over the righteous. It was only necessary that church members keep the commandments, watch, and be faithful. While it is true that Mormons had looked for the second coming of Christ since the 1830s, opposition to polygamy was counted as further evidence that the time was near. Responding to the United States Supreme Court's decision in the Reynolds case, L. John Nuttall wrote in his diary that the cup of iniquity was full and that surely the Lord would shortly come out of his hiding place and vex the nation. Apostle Erastus Snow said in 1884 that the day was near at hand when Joseph and Hiram Smith would be resurrected, and Christ would appear among his followers. When the House of Representatives approved the Edmunds-Tucker Act in 1887, Wilford Woodruff warned that Congress had turned the last key that seals their condemnation and lays the foundation for the overthrow and final destruction of the United States government. The completion of Utah's first four temples between the years 1877 and 1893 corresponded with hardships associated with the anti-polygamy crusade and contributed to Mormon expectations that special events were soon to occur. Sensing the dedication of church members, Apostle John Henry Smith told a priesthood gathering in 1888 that if the church's leaders would only show the way, the people would certainly follow. During a meeting of the apostles only 4 months before the manifesto was written, President of the Quorum Lorenzo Snow told his brethren, they would not die, but would live to see the Savior and participate in the great work of the world's closing scenes. And Apostle John Henry Smith again, less than 10 days before the manifesto, stated to a church conference in St. George that no principle or revelation that God ever gave to his people was to be laid on the shelf as a thing of the past. We must recall as another element in the Mormon mind of that time what it is the modern church has purposely and quite successfully forgotten: the extraordinary significance attached by 19th century Mormons to the principle of plural marriage. It was, said some, the most important truth given the world by the restored church. It revealed the domestic economy of the gods. Polygamy, it was claimed, alone promised to eliminate prostitution and other forms of sexual corruption. It brought hygienic and biological benefits, some promised, of a startling nature. It was said to have the capacity for restoring the longevity of the ancient patriarchs. It assured correct government in the home, and therewith greater peace and stability in society at large. Some called it the chief cornerstone of the work. Others said its implementation was a necessary prerequisite for the return of Christ and commencement of the millennium. Closely associated with the importance of plural marriage was the insistence placed on living it as a commandment of God. Mere belief in the doctrine was not enough. Men were told they must actually engage in the practice. George Q. Cannon informed an audience in St. George that he was reluctant to lift his hand to sustain any presiding officer who had not entered the principle. Church elders were told that having a dead woman sealed to them or living consecutive polygamy by taking a new wife after a former one passed away was not enough. One must live with more wives than one at the same time. It was a requirement for membership in the revived School of the Prophets during the 1880s. There was, for example, a question whether to admit John Smith, Patriarch of the Church, because he smoked and, though husband to two wives, spent all his time with only one. Considering these things, the importance of the tenet, assurances that God would protect them, that he would put a hook in the mouths of their oppressors and deliver them, why then was there a manifesto? Justifications given at the time it was submitted in conference that church members had suffered enough and that President Woodruff was guiding the saints by prayer and inspiration only beg the question. Recognition of untoward circumstances confronting the church does not reconcile the event with the promises and statements of previous years. To call the Woodruff document a victory because it was issued only probably was not intended by the leaders to be the great dividing line it later became. It is true the document was initially contrived as little more than a tactic, and that approved plural marriages continued to be performed for years to come. It is also true that the statement waited nearly two decades before it was included in the Doctrine and Covenants, and that it passed through several stages of interpretation before acquiring the regard it has today. This said, it was still an event of traumatic consequence for many. When presented, the manifesto took numbers by surprise, provoking sadness and disappointment. It was said that gloom filled the tabernacle after announcement of its approval. Some sobbed with regret. There were general authorities who were unhappy with the move. And notwithstanding subsequent church accounts describing the vote on the document as unanimous, we know it was not, and that many refused to vote at all. President Woodruff himself later admitted that numbers in the church were sorely tried by what he had done. Puzzlement over the issuance of the manifesto lingered as late as the time of the publication by Brigham H. Roberts of his Comprehensive History of the Church. Discussing the response brought by the manifesto, Roberts pointed out that with all that the Latter-day Saints had suffered, they were prepared to suffer more. The thought of surrendering it, plural marriage, he said, had never occurred to the great body of the church, and they were slow to be reconciled to the action. In his discussion, Roberts betrayed question, if not doubt, as to the necessity of the manifesto in almost every paragraph he wrote about it. The most he seemed able to say, by way of justification, was that God's purposes were his own. Years later, one of Kimball Young's interviewees, telling of the blow the manifesto had been to him, said that while eventually reconciled to the document, his first question had been, could it be that the Lord had made a mistake? The sense that a great cause had been inexplicably denied them afflicted some for years. Paraphrasing the sentiments of a pluralist who consented to an interview in the 1930s, one student described the man's feelings about the period after the manifesto as being what he called the hardest times. Until then, those engaged in the principle had the consolation that they were doing right and living their religion. The persecution did not matter. But with renunciation of the principle, he said, all that had given them a sense of cause was taken away. There was, however, an answer that could be used to explain what had happened. The principle had not failed. Neither had their oracles led them astray. Plurality remained a truth, and God had not broken his promises. Rather, just as I was told as a child, the saints themselves were responsible for the cessation of plural marriage. The practice of God's holy law was postponed for a more deserving generation. Suggestion that Mormon failure was involved appeared at least as early as a year after the manifesto's issuance, in a sermon by First Presidency Counselor George Q. Cannon. On that occasion, he was explicit in saying that the document was given because the saints had failed in their religious responsibilities. In April of 1893, in a lecture given in the Salt Lake Temple, Joseph F. Smith said much the same thing. And Apostle Matthias F. Kelly, in a 1901 address, repeated that it was failure by the church to observe what had been revealed to them that accounted for the manifesto. This was a departure from explanations given by both Canon and President Wilford Woodruff when the manifesto was first presented to the saints in conference, as Leo Lyman has pointed out. At that time, perseverance shown by church members was memorialized, and they were told the Lord was relieving them from further trial. In his remarks, Canon referred to an 1841 revelation excusing them from further efforts in behalf of an assignment frustrated by their enemies. The 1841 communication said exemption from a command to build a temple in Missouri was justified because they had done all they could and continued striving in the face of great opposition was unnecessary. Canon's use of this earlier episode was a change, however, from what the church was told only 5 years before. In an 1885 editorial in the Deseret News, it was said that any seeking to use the 1841 revelation as precedent for discontinuing polygamy were moral weaklings. Such individuals, it said, needed a ramrod fastened parallel with their spinal column. The article went on to say that circumstances giving rise to the 1841 revelation were entirely different from those confronting the saints in the 1880s. The former had to do with the erection of a physical structure. They either could or could not perform the task. Now, said the news, they were dealing with a law, an eternal principle. The 1841 revelation was not applicable. In other words, there seems to have been something of a shift after the initial presentation of the manifesto, as its acceptance came to be viewed by Mormons themselves as a genuine statement of altered policy and behavior. The charge of Mormon error was not confined to remarks by the church's leaders, such as those I have mentioned and pointed to already. And it is in comment by lay members that we encounter the most telling references to where it was the saints had fallen down. Recounting a conversation with an older Mormon woman in the early 1890s, Florence Miriam remembered that the woman had said the manifesto came about because so many were not living plurality correctly. It had, she said, become almost a curse to us. The journalist Richard Berry reported another Mormon to say the saints had fallen into such unrighteousness in practicing polygamy that had to bring it to a halt. Another, Victoria Jackson, said the reason the Lord ceased fighting their battles was because the law of plural marriage was dragged into the gutter. Old men swapped daughters. Sex weakness predominated in many cases. Some men neglected present wives and were captivated by a younger face. Joseph Lee Robinson later told of his concern that during the 1880s and 90s, much wickedness had emerged in connection with the practice of polygamy. As late as 1980, the daughter of a Mormon pluralist remarked that polygamy, quote, was taken away because so much abuse had crept into it. Whether or not Mormon polygamy had morally degenerated to the degree statements like these suggest, I suspect they are exaggerated. They tell of Mormon suspicion that not all was right in the households of those living the celestial law. Uneasiness about Mormon polygamous behavior is what invites the comparison with Southern misgiving as described by Kenneth Stamp. Citing examples, including the relative rapidity with which Southern states joined in opposing slavery after the Civil War, as distinct from racism, which of course continued both North and South. Stamp argues that for reasons of which they were often only partly conscious, the Southern will was eroded by moral equivocation. The parallel is not exact, and the issue more complicated because Mormons believed plural marriage had been revealed to them by God. A Mormon challenging plurality in any fundamental way risked more than cultural treason. He courted heresy and damnation. Unlike those Southerners who Stamp said secretly fretted over their cause, few saints are likely to have questioned the abstract rightfulness of plural marriage. The Mormon's struggle lay within himself and arose from what he perceived to be personal shortcomings in practicing the principle. We know, for example, that romantic and exclusive inclinations haunted many polygamous relationships. The persistence of such assumptions has been noted by students of the Mormon polygamous family for decades. Yet, opposed to such feelings were urgings by their leaders that plurality was the better way and that all saints should strive to be worthy to live it. Monogamous sentiments undoubtedly acted as an incubus on the consciences of many, pluralists and non-pluralists, men and women alike. More crucially, and what particularly recommends the theme of guilt as part of the Mormon response to the manifesto, is the nervousness felt by many saints about their sexual behavior. Most of this, I believe, revolved around the question of whether and to what degree sexual activity was to be enjoyed apart from its use for reproduction. General approval of erotic pleasure in marriage previous to the Mormon removal west seems to me to have given way to a more rigoristic ethic in the latter half of the 19th century. This was partly due, undoubtedly, to uncertainties felt by Americans generally about sexual purpose. Anxiety was sharpened by the fact that despite growing acceptance of the importance of romance, medical advice manuals of the time warned of the dangers sexual indulgence could bring, and Victorians sometimes tortured acutely over what to do with the pleadings of their glands. Mormon apologetics in behalf of polygamy itself, or themselves, also contributed to increased sensitivity about the propriety of sexual pleasure. Except for expressions of outrage over Gentile hypocrisy, it is unlikely that any subject connected with sexuality occupied Mormon spokesmen more often than denials that gratification of the flesh had anything to do with plural marriage. One might argue, of course, that this was a reaction formation, betraying Mormon anxiety on the subject. Whatever its reason, reproduction was set forth with impassioned emphasis as the near exclusive function of sexual relations. The saints were sermonized and warned repeatedly to beware of non-reproductive indulgence. Indeed, this was identified by Mormon leaders as one of the gifts of plurality, that multiple partners permitted men to more easily fulfill their needs while confining themselves to reproductively purposed sexual activity. Polygamy, they said, minimized the profligacy they believed inherent in monogamy. Criticism of their failure to measure up in the matter had flowed across Mormon pulpits for years. Brigham Young said abuse of the principle was sending thousands to hell. And Heber C. Kimball said there were hundreds and thousands in the church who were not living celestial marriage as it was intended. In a sermon in Springville, Utah, Apostle Orson Hyde upbraided the saints for what he called their secret sins. He was specific in warning couples to avoid sexual congress except for reproduction. He admitted that, especially in its early years, polygamy had led many into what he called sexual excess. And during the 1880s, Apostle Erastus Snow told the Mormon colonists in Mexico that too many men were rushing into plurality for the wrong reasons. A common, often dominant refrain in attacks made upon the saints, as it had been in criticisms of the South, was that religion and philosophy were no more than scaffolding, a front, to cover what it was that really motivated them, common animal lust. Sexual criticisms by abolitionists of the Old South were adapted and used against the Mormons. And Mormons, despite public denials, must sometimes have internalized such remarks, if only as private self-interrogation, a tendency reinforced by the admonitions of their leaders that principle, not passion, must govern them in their marital relations. The intense nature of the 1880s, with its emphasis on righteous perseverance in the face of attacks from their enemies, sensitized church members to personal failure. The struggle many had with monogamous impulses must have acted as an accusing witness of their selfishness and doubt. But the emphasis on a strict reproductive employment of sex would have been especially keen as a testament to the weakness of the flesh. Mormon preachment created an ideal that was difficult to attain. And, as Freud reminded us, the territory between what we desire and what others tell us we ought to desire is a region fertile with guilt. In his essay, Kenneth Stamp suggested that what he found in the South could be duplicated often in history. Individuals and societies engaged in great moral conflicts not infrequently internalized the issues in ways that, even if unconscious, profoundly affect the outcome of events. So much so, he said, that they sometimes actually invite defeat. Whether it would be correct to say Mormon anxiety acted so powerfully as to contribute to surrender on the practice of polygamy, I am unsure. That is not the claim of this paper. I have tried to suggest, however, that such feelings were recruited after the manifesto, by at least some, as a way to explain what had happened to them. This agrees, incidentally, with the research of Leon Festinger. Festinger, you might recall, is the author of the phrase cognitive dissonance, the idea that the problem of what people do when an internal belief system is found to come into conflict with reality. And Festinger and his associates found that, surprisingly, when prophecies or theological certitudes fail, rather than precipitating a collapse of belief, most often, most followers in religious movements rebound with even greater faith than before. What do we do with those folks who continue to attend the services and send money to Jimmy and Tammy and Jimmy Swaggart? How do you account for that sort of persistence of belief? The process, according to Festinger and his associates, seems to involve the invention of a rationale consistent with former assumptions that explains the disappointment or failure. The rationale itself is then adduced as a further evidence that what they had believed was indeed true. The saints had been told that plurality was a dangerously powerful thing, equally capable of bringing great blessings or great sorrow and evil. Like an edged tool, it must be handled carefully. Because too many had not lived the higher law as it was intended, just as they had been warned, it brought trouble upon them, and the principle was taken away. The crisis of belief precipitated by the 1890 Declaration must have unleashed a variety of emotions. Its loss struck through Mormon psychology in many directions. Apostle Matthias F. Kelly, for example, more than a decade after the manifesto, said that Mormon society was witness to a generation of immoral women because their mothers had not displayed sufficient regard for the principle when it was permitted. Another Latter-day Saint, joined to a plural wife by a high church authority in 1903, yet uncertain about the meaning of the manifesto, blamed the birth of a retarded child on relations he had had with his plural wife. One is reminded of Anne Fior Scott's description of Southern attitudes after the war between the states, when she paraphrased a Southern lady to say that the 4 years of bloody civil war was a fit penance for so many sexual sins. By recalling their doubts, their hesitations associated with plurality, and the sting of guilt for what Apostle Orson Hyde called their secret sins, Mormons were able to save a recent passage of their history from what must otherwise have been seen as inexplicable defeat. By resorting to self-blame, regard for their leaders and the principle remained intact. God had not abandoned them. They had failed him. The manifesto, they could reason, was a consequence of their own sins.
In order that you'll have time to respond, I'll be very, very brief. I want to thank, on behalf of Dialogue, Leo and Carmen for their papers. Provocative, I think Leo, again, as he did in his book, reminds us of political causation. And by using those fantastic primary resources, I'm reminded for future historians writing about the 20th century and the late 20th century, whether or not they will ever have access to journals and diaries and letters that really try to explain what's going on, and they're honest in what they write in them. And then I think Carmen has given us an explanation that I find very, very intriguing, and one that is used. I remember it being used in 1978 and before on Priesthood in the Blacks, how the members of the church were not worthy to accept other races, hadn't lived them
their lives in such a way that they could accept all people, and so consequently it was their fault that the policy existed rather than that the policy existed. Another thought that came to me as I read these papers was, I think this is an important period in LDS history because of a transition that's taking place. And one is a transition that must have reached down and slapped people very, very hard, and that was that they may not live to see the second coming. That the millennialism that had really been part of the LDS practice, I think by the 1890s, a lot of people were realizing they're going to hang around a while. And that, and part of it is also that they're becoming believers in their own article of faith, that they have to subject themselves to governments and kings, and they become more Americanized. I think someone could have could take off on Tom Alexander's book when he writes on this period of transition, 1890 to 1920, and talk also about how economic survival becomes a part of this after a series of devastating agriculture depressions and people trying to survive economically with multiple families, what an impact this has during this period as well. I'm reminded of many things in reading this, but one thing is how does an organization retreat? How does an ecclesiastical organization take its people that they have, as you illustrated, you've pounded on a principle for decades that this is God's way, this is what we're going to live or die on, and how do you retreat from that? I think it's an amazing story, and I think that's why a discussion of this 100 years later is very central, because the manifesto is really a watershed period in Mormon history. As a major, whether or not they continued to perform plural marriages and people continued to splinter and do a variety of things after, but the admission on the part of the church that they were going to back away from it, and then how do you take the people with you when you've been putting them on the line for it for decades? I think that's an amazing story. See, and in LDS theology, you always have an out, and that's the idea of continuous revelation. If you think the people believe the prophet, or if the prophet's explanation when it tears families asunder is enough, or whether or not it was a revelation or a politically motivated document. But nevertheless, I think to retreat is often more difficult than to advance. It really is how the church wants to use continuous revelation and whether or not they really want to bring everybody along and try to keep them in line with it. But I'm very pleased with the papers. I hope you have an interesting response to them. As you ask questions from the audience, I think I'll put the microphone down there, and then I'll ask you, if it's a directory, to repeat the question for the tapes. If you didn't know you were being taped, it's too damn late. You're taped. Okay, any questions? I'll direct. Yes, in the pink dress, yeah. I guess that's
I've in the diaries and journals I've researched, I, at the moment, can recall two instances, one of which was a prominent state president in southern Utah. And in his case, he continued to marry subsequent wives. I think he finally acquired six or seven, not knowing, I guess, that it was his problem. And I don't know the conclusion of the story, except that no children were ever born to the entire family. Part of the problem, I suppose, is the want of biological knowledge in those days, that sometimes, or perhaps even often, it was male infertility that was the difficulty.
Yes, you're back there.
Was there any evidence that the brethren understood that they were running out of women potential for plural marriage? The argument is made by non-general authorities, certainly Frank Cannon testifying before Congress indicates that there are many young people who do not believe that it's a divine principle anymore, and that they're determined to not be dragged into it. I haven't seen any evidence that the brethren considered that argument that there weren't enough potential wives. I've never seen that. And I've probably read as many of the brethren's diaries as anyone. Carmen?
I'm unaware either of what the official response might have been to that. Certainly I concur that the evidence is very strong that that was so. One particular datum that contributes to that conclusion, as you know, is the increasing youth of the girls that were married in order to provide partners for polygamous households.
And the young men were very restless because they couldn't find anybody to marry.
Often that were the case. I have also heard it suggested, and this is a suggestion only that was made, that the increasingly high percentage that we are now coming to realize were engaged in polygamy. I think Ben Benyon's research suggests that on average between 20 and 30% of most Mormon communities were involved in polygamous family life, that may actually have been the absolute ceiling to which they could have reached because of the problem that you mentioned, the want of sufficient spouses. But what the official response was, if such a response was made, like Leo, I am unaware of it.
In the back, ma'am.
Have we personally analyzed ourselves and confronted ourselves on the question of how we feel about plural marriage? On the feeling level, have we reacted to polygamy? My first reaction is, I can remember letting my wife share some of the documents and her chuckling, saying it is serve you right. I adopted as a hero very early Abram Cannon, who the year he married his third wife, the first two asked for divorce. And he seems like the most eligible man in the church. I don't see it working very well, and I rejected it very early on in my experience with it. I would have wanted nothing to do with it. And that's on a feeling level. I do not have a testimony of polygamy.
I guess generally I would concur. The issue you raise is a fascinating one, and one that I think most people in most academic disciplines struggle with at one level or another, and that is the problem of identifying with your subject. And when you're dealing with something as emotionally tractable as polygamy, sexuality, family life, the issue, so far as I'm concerned, never entirely disappears. And of course, it's made even more important and underlined to a greater degree by the fact that it was supposed to have been a divine commandment. It was all mixed up with theology and whatnot. I suppose that while I never entirely have succeeded in totally disengaging, you can't read some of the diaries and the materials without identification with the people, particularly the women. My own response is very, very similar, again, to Leo's. I'm about as red-blooded, I think, as they come, but I feel no affinity for the institution, at least as it was practiced under Mormon direction, and find, if anything, an enormous pathos emerging in my feelings, especially for the women. I know the argument was always made, well, it's hard on the men too, and that sort of thing, but I think there was no comparison with the hardships that were imposed on the women by it. The comment was made that in studying and thinking about plural marriage, it's very difficult, at least in this gentleman's case, to do so as he understands it without coming to an acceptance or an affirmation of the equal rightfulness of polyandry as well as polygamy. It might be interesting because a good deal of the manuscript that Vic Jorgensen and I have been working with addresses that issue in part. the answer in the 19th century by Mormon authorities, and the question was asked often by both non-Mormons and Mormons. Well, if it's okay for men, why isn't it okay for women? And the answer was one that found widespread, very broad support, not only within the Mormon community, but outside it, and that is that women simply were not fitted for multiple partners. A man could reproduce with many women, but a woman, by her biology, simply can't reproduce as frequently nor over as long a lifespan as a man. Beyond this, the assumption was that she was not as sexually driven as a man, and there are very explicit statements to that effect, not only in the medical literature of the day in the 19th century, but in Mormon preachment and discourse. Consequently, one of the Mormon arguments for polygamy, you see, was that they were simply bringing the institution of marriage into harmony with nature, which was that it provided an outlet for men that monogamy did not provide, and that women were biologically, at least, and emotionally not fitted for multiple partners. Well, very briefly, one reconciliation was the thesis of the paper I presented, which was that the saints blamed themselves. That way, the promises made by the brethren and the leaders could yet be preserved, you see. It's just that the saints had not been sufficiently faithful. But one other comment with regard to your question, which was how you reconcile theologically, if I understand it, the failure of many of the promises that were made with the implicit surrender, at least, involved in the manifesto. I think it's important that we also recall that at the time the manifesto was not looked upon as a divine deliverance. In fact, there was a good deal of debate, and I think until well after the turn of the century, there were many individuals, at least some that testified in the Smoot hearings, that it was not a revelation, so that would have muted the kind of dissonance or conflict, theological conflict, that you point to.
As I tried to point out, the ones who were already in plural marriage did not feel that they were supposed to stop. It was simply to tell the ones who hadn't yet got with it that it was too late, that they couldn't. And there really wasn't anyone saying it was revelation right then. President Woodruff later said he received some divine instruction that said the temples would be destroyed and desecrated if they didn't make the strategic retreat. And there's a great deal of evidence they intended it to be a temporary retreat. Certainly not a permanent.
The question... The question is there any evidence at the time that it was considered a revelation? I think that probably what is cited in Van Wagener's book was the 1891 statement by Woodruff and some of the apostles as well at the Master and Chancery hearings, where he said that, yes, he considered that he had been inspired, and to him, inspiration was the same as revelation. He equated the two, and that was stated very early. But so far as I know, the affirmations that are now made, which directly categorize it as a revelation, that was a process of evolution. And if I recall correctly, even Apostle Mariner W. Merrill, in his diary, said as early as 1891 or so, he was one of those consulted by Woodruff when he wrote the manifesto, that he did not consider it a revelation himself.
In that connection,
I don't have a good answer to that. It seems to me like that was more Joseph Smith's phraseology, and no one wanted to infringe on his style. They all looked to him as the prophet. I just wanted to say a word concerning the testimony of President Woodruff before that chancery court. Abraham Cannon's diary makes it very clear that he regretted some of the statements he made there and wished he could erase them, and practiced as if they had not been said.
The comment was made that one authority within recent years has suggested that in connection with the expanding growth of the church and the great missionary effort that it's undertaking, that it will undoubtedly come into contact with many polygamous peoples. And I'm not sure, did Nelson make a remark as to what the church would do in those cases?
I ought to stay out of this. I would really, my guess is in knowing how missionaries operate and how they do around different areas, you know, how hard they work in certain cultures to have couples get married that have been living together for a long time, and that becomes one of the prerequisites even before baptism. My guess is if they moved into a plural situation where they were teaching, that they would not be able to respect that cultural situation and go through the process of baptism, let alone temple endowments. But I don't know, but that's just a gut reaction. Yes?
I respond to that. I would just return.
I really won't try to summarize that. I think you're going to speak later. The comment was made from a gentleman who'd recently returned from missions in third world countries where he'd had to deal with this, and that the practice was that you could not baptize them while they were living polygamy until the man died. I think we've gone over time, so if you want to wrestle with these two gentlemen while others are eating, you can. Thank you all very, very much.